curse.
Welcome to No Prize from God, episode 40. No Prize from God features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey, and my guest this episode is Bill Fisher of Church of the Cosmic Skull. Let me tell you what Metal Hammer has to say about Church of the Cosmic Skull. Finally, a cult worth joining. British faux gospel prog rockers Church is an entirely enigmatic project led by singer-guitarist Bill Fisher, and the band's mystical origins and white robe stage attire carry all the trappings of an early 70s cult. But their sound is rooted firmly in crunching classic era arena rock. It's like Ghost and the Polyphonic Spree proselytizing in some high-watt megachurch. Elsewhere, the band channeled the grandeur of Queen and the acid burn of Hawkwind, frequently enthralling with a balance of doomy invocations and life-affirming positivity. Brother Bill, as Fisher is known, describes Church of the Cosmic Skull as a rock band and a spiritual organization who welcome all living beings with open arms. There are all sorts of concepts woven throughout their different records, including ideas about the cult of personality, the thirst for fame, and a positive acceptance of mortality. The band's website, cosmicskull.org, teleports you into an invitation to join their congregation, offering a 7-step plan to deprogram your mind called The Path. At the time I am taping this episode intro, the band has 4 records out. 2016 debut is Satan Real, 2018 Science Fiction, 2019's Everybody's Going to Die, and 2022's There Is No Time. Brother Bill's influences include Queen, The Beatles, Thin Lizzy, Kate Bush, Bowie, Peter Gabriel. The band has Hammond organ, pianos, strings, all sorts of vocal harmonies. There's some Beach Boys in there. They've covered Pink Floyd. And the last time I looked, there were 7 people listed in the band. Given the religious iconography, the whole sort of thematic setup of a cult-type congregation or assembly, the different sort of theological questions posited in the lyrics, you know, not only made Brother Bill a perfect candidate as someone to invite onto this show, but somebody that I was very excited and interested in talking with. This interview actually has been sitting in the vaults for a while, since October 2020, actually, and I'm recording this intro in May 2023. I've got some more in the vaults, and I will be getting them edited, getting them out to you, and getting brand new episodes going at the same time. Remember, you can keep up with everything related to me at ryanjdowney.com, where you can find info about No Prize from God, which is also at noprizefromgod.com. And my other podcasts, Speak and Destroy and Pop Curse. And generally sort of keep up with everything else that I'm doing, if you're so inclined. So here it is, my conversation with Bill Fisher of Church of the Cosmic Skull. This is No Prize from God.
You think that when you are dead, you stain your grave.
ones did you check out?
Max Caballero.
Oh, nice. Which
was interesting. What was the other one? Satyricon guy.
Oh, great. Satyr, yeah. The Max one was super interesting. I didn't realize, and I've actually known Max for a few years, but I didn't realize until that conversation, you know, things like him getting baptized at the Vatican and,
yeah,
you know.
Is it him or his dad? Or, yeah, it was,
yeah. His dad was some sort of official in Rome. And then there was, you know, possessions and exorcisms and all sorts of wild stuff happening in his home. I absolutely am a fan of what you're doing, what you've built. It helps that it comes from a genre of music that I enjoy. And I know you have some background in the doom scene a little bit too, which is easily my favorite subgenre of my favorite genre. So I figured, yeah, there was a lot of great overlap there. So what can you tell me about your first experiences with faith, doctrines or lack thereof, and, you know, being confronted with life's big questions? When did you first start wondering about that stuff for yourself, and what were some of the things that were presented to you early on?
Well, my mum is a born again Christian, and my dad was a cynic, shall we say. So he was very much coming from a kind of scientific angle. And they were pretty much at loggerheads with that whole thing. Interestingly though, as my dad sort of got older and he only died recently, it was interesting to see that he actually did sort of start embracing some of that sort of faith-based stuff in a very loose way, mostly sort of around music. So, you know, you'll kind of have artists, won't you, who sing about God, things like that, but not necessarily kind of from a place of faith themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was, you know, I mean, I suppose a lot of people, as they get older, they are drawn more towards that. But yeah, so from an early age, there was that kind of the two sides of the coin. And I think, I don't know, that's always been interesting to me. So I've always kind of seen, I've always taken it with a bit of a pinch of salt, but I wasn't on either of their side, if you know what I mean. So I kind of get frustrated by the staunch atheist kind of characters. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? That kind of...
I do.
in the last kind of 10, 15 years or so.
I feel like that has really dominated the conversation. And that was really part of the origin story of this podcast was, you know, in scrolling through the categories in Apple Podcasts, you see in the religion and spirituality category, you see a lot of evangelicals, new agey self-help stuff, militant atheism. And I just thought, you know, as someone who's been fascinated by everyone from HR, the Bad Brains, to Black Sabbath, to, you know, any creative individuals, filmmakers, musicians who grapple with this stuff without coming from one of those crystal clear sort of done to death viewpoints, you know, it's like, well, where's all the conversations with those folks, or people who are coming from what we might associate with being mainline or you know, type faith traditions, but have a unique experience with it to talk about versus just, you know, regurgitating the talking points of proselytizing to you.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost feels a little, I mean, when the whole sort of Dawkins and Gervais thing was happening, it all just felt a little bit like that was what everybody was just talking about when we were 16. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like a new thing.
Yeah.
But they were saying it as if it was this new revelation. And they're both English, actually, aren't they? And they were sort of big in America. Maybe America is a little more religious still. I don't know.
Well, you know, when they talk about the four horsemen of atheism, And Christopher Hitchens was one. And he was, of course, I believe he was born in Malta, but he was an Englishman living in America. And I'm a big fan of the late Christopher Hitchens prior to his, you know, turn to sort of that becoming his main crusade. And not to say that I stopped being a fan over that, but just him as a writer and a worldly traveler type. I was always into his stuff. But yeah, that's a great point that you make, that it felt very surfacey, very teenage angst-ish. And the idea that, and I think this is where I really have a difficult time with Dawkins in particular, the idea that religion, specifically Christianity, is the root cause of evil, you know, that the dismantling of it, that the disproving of faith is some sort of essential step in humankind's evolution and civilization. I mean, of course, there's countless examples of barbarism and violence done in the name of all sorts of different religions, but the idea that the ideas themselves are, you know, it's just as much nonsense to me as banning horror films because people are murdered in real life, you know.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. I think it is, yeah, it's that kind of, it's the censorship sort of element. I mean, I always do err on the side of, you know, Sagan and that kind of like scientific approach and like, do we really need it? Or when there's an explanation for everything scientifically, you don't then need to rely on God or religion, but it just sort of feels like there's other things to explore within religion, which I think are interesting.
Agreed.
Just kind of things like, you know, not necessarily the moral code, but just on a sort of mental health level. Like I've looked into Buddhism quite a lot, and do you know what I mean? To me, that's one of the few that really kind of lays it out very sort of like methodically how to kind of become happier, if not really happy. And not necessarily in a kind of, you know, it doesn't involve worship necessarily. It's more of like a sort of methodical way of thinking, changing the way you think. And I don't think that science can just sort of, you know, you can't reach these conclusions just by kind of testing hypothesis. You know, the scientific method doesn't directly apply to, you know, human feelings.
Yeah, and there's that whole idea that science can ultimately, at some point in the distant future, perhaps give us every explanation as to how of things, but isn't designed by its nature to give us the why, you know. Yeah. So science can explain, well, here's how this happened, but it's up to philosophy and spirituality to try to determine any type of why or purpose or lack thereof. Sure. And I also would posit that I'm of two minds lately, especially on the one hand, I think that there are things unseen and undiscovered that science could eventually get to, in the same way that, you know, radio waves are around us. And before we had instruments to tune into them and use them and communicate with them, it was just something that it was invisible, you know, but it didn't mean it wasn't there. And on the other hand, and this is something that's I've been thinking about very recently, and this ties into England pretty specifically. Are you familiar with the show The Last Kingdom?
I'm not.
It's a British show that's historical fiction, and it's really about kind of the creation of England and the United Kingdom, and the battle between the Danes and the Saxons, and it gets really into the varied religious beliefs of, you know, that Saxon Christianity and the Danes with Odin and Thor and all the Viking myths. And then just, I binged that show and I loved it. And in watching it, and not to say that the show gets super deep into this, but it made me question and think about for the first time, we view historical beliefs through this lens of modernism. And I've been wondering, when someone talked about or described or told stories about Thor, for example, we have this idea that they pictured a literal person in the sky swinging a hammer, right? And I'm wondering now, was that the case? Was that really what all of them thought, or even any of them thought? Or was it more, you know, just like you have literalists and fundamentalists who truly believe that the Noah's Ark story or that Jonah was swallowed by a whale. But then I think you have, you know, a much larger portion of folks who see those stories as allegorical and as describing things that were perhaps difficult or almost impossible to describe as they happened. So yeah, that's just kind of something I've been pondering lately is, you know, for a lot of even those pagan ideas, like, were they really as literally minded as we assume?
Well, I think it's that thing of like, does that even really matter? Because it's like, especially with these ones, with the religions that have kind of pantheons or just, you know, multiple gods, which kind of represent different things. That gets me to thinking about the, what's it called? What would Jesus do? Mm. You know, the wristbands, which was always kind of a funny thing that, again, in England, at least, people would kind of take the piss out of, because it's like such a, you know, such a kind of Christian, slightly culty thing, isn't it?
Indeed.
But I think it was, I can't remember the book, but it was a Buddhist thing again. And it was kind of this concept of like using this figure, this person in history, in this case, let's say it was Jesus or Buddha. It's that concept of like, as you're making decisions or as you're kind of going around your daily life, you have this kind of personification of this kind of ultimate human. So it kind of, it reminds you to sort of act in a much more relaxed way and like take a little time to think about your reaction. Don't just kind of go in with anger. You see what I'm saying? And I think that applies definitely to sort of like Buddha and Jesus and the kind of the traditional prophets. But you know, if you imagine when you have a pantheon, it actually applies to lots of different situations. So you have, you know, if you were to be wearing a "What Would Thor Do" bracelet, maybe that would, you know, you'd be better in battle, for instance. Or, you know, in the simple way of like, you could, this idea of inventing your own kind of characters or mythological gods, you could have the god of gigs. So you imagine the ultimate kind of performer, and then you just embody that. So it's, I don't know, it feels like within that, especially the ones with pantheons, like you say, I think there's a sort of something there where it's like we can kind of tap in, and we can sort of like draw from these different kind of extreme versions of personalities.
A way to even sort of describe or and identify what those qualities are by personifying them, and a way to then communicate to others the conclusions you've come to about how and why this should behave. And I think this also makes a great argument for the idea of a figurative resurrection in the Christian story, as opposed to a literal resurrection. The idea that even the act of wearing one of those goofy "What Would Jesus Do" wristbands is a type of resurrection of this figure that might otherwise have been lost to history, but is in fact revived and spread around and constantly resurrected and reinvigorated in the talk and discussion and worship and thought about this person.
Yeah, that's something I've thought about. It's a little along, it's kind of along the lines of like, does God exist? It's just a subjective thing, isn't it? So to say that he doesn't exist is kind of ridiculous, because just as an idea, it does exist and it has an effect on the world.
Right. Right. So. Yes. And in that sense, exists just as much as the doom metal genre exists, because it's something that we've come up with. And
people I know who would argue that it doesn't, but
right. Usually the inventors of it, which is interesting, because that tends to be how religion works too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I mean, how many times did Lemmy say that Motorhead wasn't metal? And this, you know, it's interesting when you were talking about your father, it made me think about this quote, which I pulled up, which is one of my favorite quotes. And where did it go? It's from Bono, of all folks, and from an interview with Rolling Stone about 15 years ago, where he said that
Bono in another podcast, didn't you?
I probably the same quote. The music that really turns me on is either running away. The music that really turns me on is either running toward God or away from God. Both recognize the pivot that God is at the center of the jaunt. And that sounds to me a little bit about like what you were describing with your father, of being attracted to sort of, you know, later in his life, art that was grappling with these questions and not necessarily from a point of view of here's the answer, you know, one way or the other.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing though. I think you could say the same about love, but then, you know, God is love. I don't know. I mean, I suppose the danger of the argument that, you know, just because people have turned it into a thing through belief, or if that's all it is, then anything can be true and you lose sight of actual truth. This is what the atheists would argue, isn't it? It's the giant spaghetti monster and all that business. And in some ways, you know, the cosmic skull is part of that kind of concept of, like, you're accepting the illusion or the hallucinatory nature of reality. So whether it's real or not, whether we believe in it or not, it's, you know, it's both and neither.
And that's one of the seven objects of the church.
Indeed.
And you know, this gets right into what we're talking about even more specifically. One of the themes of, you know, it's right there in the album title, Everybody's Going to Die. One of the themes of that record is the acceptance of death, but not from a point of despair, but more from a point of even joyousness almost, which reminds me of, you know, a theologian whose work I talk about a lot on the podcast, Pete Rollins. It's very much in tune with his ideas. He actually created a little character called Happy Death, which is a grim reaper with a smile. if you could elaborate on that concept a bit, I'd love to hear your perspective on it.
The concept of that really came about before I think I'd even started the band. And it was kind of, it was that thing of realizing that you're going to die. I mean, everybody has realized that, but it's kind of that thing of like, well, what would you do if you knew you were going to die next year? Would you stick with the same job that you're in? Would you, you know, what are the things that you want to do? You might as well. And it was just that kind of like, I might as well just try and do these ridiculous things, which will probably be quite fun. Because, you know, we're definitely going to die at some point. I suppose that's the thing. It's supposed to be kind of inspirational as opposed to everybody's going to die, so let's all get under the covers and sob. It's like, let's go and do all of the lovely things that we want to do, or at least try. And I think this is the thing, is that it's that same kind of idea of the, if everybody was in a, you know, utopia where like everything was abundant, I don't believe that everybody would just kind of sit around in the sun, drinking and copulating, etc. I think that people would actually do creative things. So it's kind of that thing, you know, it's everybody's going to die.
And I think some of those creative things would be disruptive, right? Well, like, wouldn't, you know, I mean, that's part of art is disruption. And yeah, the idea of an eternity of everyone being chill, I think would be boring.
Oh, yeah, I mean, people would quickly start fighting just for the fun of it, I think.
Yeah, indeed, the sport of it.
Yeah.
Defacing monuments and such just for the art of it, the beautiful structures and whatnot. Yeah,
I mean, that's kind of the contrarian approach, isn't it? Which again, I think that's been a big part of this, or like Discordianism, punk rock. But I mean, this, like, there was, which one was it that I was listening to? It was Max Cavalera interview that you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about how dedicating the albums to God was like a punk rock move.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is sort of a different thing, but I think just a lot of the things that we did early on, or the entire idea of kind of trying to present a sort of prog rock band, or almost prog pop approach, where it's like, it's okay to listen to Toto and, you know, Gentle Giant and Thin Lizzy.
Yeah,
it's sort of like you know you're aware that, like, actually all these people listening to kind of doom and heavy metal actually kind of like all that stuff as well, really.
Mm-hmm. So
like, it's all right, all of these things that I'd recorded and written weren't actually terrible.
it's like playing someone Ghost and then playing them Blue Oyster Cult, you know, and going, you realize this is actually what you like. You don't think you like this, but you do.
Yeah.
It's dressed up in a way that's more palatable to your aesthetics.
I mean, it's one of those things where it's sort of, it's those sort of guilty pleasures become your most sort of passionate pleasures, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I think that's another thing about getting a bit older. You sort of realize, well, hold on, I'm not bothered about being cool anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about let's just do things that we want to do. You know, let's make things we want to hear and have fun.
Yeah, indeed. Getting into Church of the Cosmic Skull, in what ways would you say it differs from a traditional band setup, and in what ways does the faith community or adherents or interested parties differ from a traditional church? You know, because it's very easy to say, well, the band's a church, the audience is, they're not fans, it's a fellowship and whatnot. But just in general, in terms of in a, I guess, a practical sense, you know, it's both a band and a church. So I suppose that the simple way of asking is, in what ways does it differ from a band traditionally, and in what ways is it different from a church?
Well, I suppose it differs from a church in the fact that the music's good.
Amen. No, amen to that.
Seriously, though. Well, actually, a big, this probably won't actually directly answer the question, but it's sort of related. One of the big influences on how we kind of approached it early on was actually looking at what's the guy's name? I think it's Fred Hammond, who is a sort of like funk gospel bassist. I don't know if you've heard of the guy. I think he's quite big in the sort of Christian, possibly sort of hip hop world now, or R&B, back in the 90s. So I found these 90s videos, which sadly aren't on the online anymore. It was Fred Hammond and Radical for Christ. And it was basically like he was the preacher, but he had this kind of like sort of 32-piece band, choir, two drummers. It was just like the most ludicrous thing I'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
They're all kind of wearing like white and beige suits, you know, but the audience was absolutely fucking rocking. And the whole sort of vibe of it was, it kind of really sort of turned me onto this idea of the presenting it in this sort of like religious way. So the key thing being that the show started with almost this kind of like subliminal message thing. It was like real kind of, the lights were down, and it was like, we are instilling fear into the audience. It's like the fear of God is upon you. Do you know what I mean? There's a synth just like, boom.
Mm-hmm.
He'll be saying stuff like, I can't remember, you know, some kind of, not directly from the Bible, but the weird thing was, is that they'd interjected these like, you know, stuff like, and you know, sometimes you'll feel anxiety. But then it'd have like this delay, so it'd be like anxiety, anxiety, anxiety. But instead of it being the same word, it'd be like pain, depression, angst.
Yeah.
I just thought this is the creepiest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, what you would picture like a recruitment video for a cult.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then they kick into this like just the greatest funk you've ever heard in your life, and it's like, this is just amazing. You know, how could we put this into a kind of prog rock saying?
Yeah, it's both and neither at the same time, which is right up the alley of what I'm fascinated with theologically. You know,
I suppose like band, you know, the bands don't tend to have the things like the seven objects. I think that's right. the main focus.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, there's an ideology around it. I mean, there's bands that have kind of slogans and things, which I've always liked delving in to the kind of geekery of it. You know,
it's, yes. It's
like the world of like Electric Wizard is a good example of this.
Mm.
There's kind of a universe they've created. They've got mm-hmm. slogans and, you know, artwork and everything. It all kind of fits in a very sort of cohesive way.
World building, like...
World building, yeah. I mean...
What we would think of as a cinematic universe now.
Yeah,
but, yeah. But yeah, having different...
Now you can do it in these multimedia ways and sort of quite, you know, quite easily. So this is hence the, you know, experimenting with the YouTube stuff we've done where it's like documentary kind of things, and I don't know if you've seen this. I've done a sort of recent series where it's like going through how to play the songs and things
yes.
like that.
Yeah, that's been like the kind of post-pandemic quarantine version of Cosmic Skull.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I'd cite On Cinema at the Cinema as an example of. I don't know if you've seen much of this, but it's a comedy series, but it's a really good example of a kind of world building scenario where they've been going over like, I think it's like 11 series now. And there's films, there's like a YouTube series, there's a podcast, there's this, that, and the other. And it's just, you know, you can absolutely kind of become immersed.
What's it called again?
On Cinema at the Cinema.
I'll have to check that out. It sounds up my alley. I mean, yes, and I love that idea of things that, you know, it goes back to me of, you know, Tolkien drawing a map and putting it in the front of The Hobbit, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. So it just sort of makes sense to, I mean, I'm into design and, you know, artwork and all that sort of thing. So it just makes sense to kind of treat it as like a whole, you know, package.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, I mean, like, again, with the seven objects, it's not as if that is a sort of premeditated, let's come up with something that a goofy religion would come up with. I mean, it is, those are actually things that I would stand behind.
And therein lies my fascination with what you're doing, because there's an element of it that's the character, or almost the role play, but the idea that all of those things are rooted in something very authentic and earnest, I think is the appeal of it. You know, you would sometimes hear Alice Cooper talk about how Alice is a character that he plays on stage, and he leaves it on the stage, and when he comes off, he's a regular guy. And then you would, by contrast, have someone like Manson who says, no, it's 24/7. You know, the person you see on stage is the person you're going to meet off stage. And I think I personally connect with something much more like what you're doing, because it's in the middle, where it's a projection, or almost a hyperextension of the truth of who you are, if that makes sense. That's the vibe that I get from it anyway, that you're
Well,
building up sort of an artifice, like a house around, but the foundation is real, if that makes sense.
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's a very flattering way of putting it, I guess. But yeah, I think that is sort of the intention, is to allow sort of enough of yourself, you know, so it's honest, but it's kind of like it's allowed to be ridiculous. Because, you know, I mean, I just sort of think that, I mean, yeah, like Bowie and to some extent Alice Cooper, like that kind of ridiculous sort of like glam rock showmanship, where it's like, you know, they're clearly doing stuff that they think is ridiculous. But it's not as if the songs aren't heartfelt and like real. Do you know what I mean? It's not a complete show. So I don't know. Well, I think it's just maybe musicians are in that sort of unique position where they can be sort of like completely heartfelt and everything on the sleeve within the song. But then somehow they're allowed to just go and portray that while they're wearing a stupid hat. And it only works to their benefit.
Well, and when those things come from a place of purity and honesty, I think that's when it connects. Because if something is, 100% piss take,
Well, that's kind
it's
of like
good for novelty for a while, right? But then the novelty is going to go away if there isn't something meaningful that's
absolutely.
powering it. And I wanted to talk about, if you'll indulge me, I figure this is the place to indulge it for both of us. I wanted to delve into the seven objects. I've got them in front of me somewhere. And the kind of the origin and the development of each of them. And of course, I'll be sure to tell people in the intro and outro of this episode about how fantastic and cosmic, if you will, the website is in terms of design and the way it works and the way that it unfolds and very much communicates the
Well,
totality of what we're talking about here. It's
that's, again,
really,
that's
really
part of
great.
the immersive kind of
Yes.
hypnotic sequence.
Immersive and hypnotic are absolutely words that I would associate with all of this. So the first of the seven objects, which you referenced already, is recognize the hallucinatory nature of reality. Is that, so you hear talk about we're living in a computer simulation, or we're in a, the various vibrations and things that are the truth, that are, we're like a projection of, there's a lot of different ways that that could be interpreted. Where did that originate for you?
Well, I guess, yeah, I mean, there's the argument of the what is it, being on the labor, you know, in the laboratory, excuse me, in the laboratory on the table.
The anthill.
I guess really that sort of sets everything else up for, it's, you know, the duality. I mean, it's the double thing as well. Like 1984, the book, was a big influence on a lot of this, even though that's more well, there's not really any religion in that at all, to some extent.
The state is the religion in that.
So it's the idea that, you know, basically truth is subjective. Is, you know, that's what we're talking with there. I mean, I'd say I believe in a lot of senses that there is truth, you know. But it's just, it's basically talking about subjective reality, less about that, the Matrix kind of universe of like, maybe we're living in a hallucination or we're living in the hologram kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because to me, that's sort of like, well, whether we are or not, it's sort of irrelevant, isn't it? You're still going to make the best of where we are, even if this is some sort of simulation.
Yeah, it's still the reality we're experiencing, which makes it reality to us. Much like harkening back to your earlier comment about, you know, Jesus exists because someone says he does. You know, God exists because, you know, in that sense. Yeah. Yeah. So then the next object, which follows naturally from the first, investigate all aspects of the reality hallucination.
Yeah.
How does one go about that in practice?
Okay, so that's really the idea that you've got, if the reality hallucination is subjective, then rather than sort of, I don't know, thinking, oh, well, nothing's real, or, you know, I don't know, that being some sort of mind-blowing scenario where you can't really do anything. It's more just, let's explore the possibilities of that. You know, maybe I could think in completely the opposite way to how I'm used to thinking.
Yeah, and that there are, you know, getting back to that idea of immersion, right? That it's using all of your senses and all of the different mediums to interpret the reality around you and experience it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a kind of just delve in. You know, we've worked out that if the first one's saying nothing is real, then the second one's saying, well, isn't that fantastic? Let's go and have a look around.
Yes. And again, that's what's attracted me to this whole thing. And the next one, receive all phenomena with equanimity, a word that I read more often than I say. but I succeeded. let's talk about that. Is this the phenomena? What are we categorizing as phenomena in that instance? I guess.
Well, this is a kind of the Buddhist thing. This is actually the kind of what would Jesus do type. You know, it's the Buddhist approach of like be equanimous. So the phenomena is just anything that, you know, somebody spitting in your face or telling you you're crap, or, you know, maybe you've seen a UFO. Maybe you think you've seen God, or you think, you know, meet it with equanimity, as in don't jump to the conclusion that it's one thing or the other. Take a little minute to think about it.
Mm. And a little bit of even turn the other cheek is in there, I think. If it's a slap in the face, or at least pause before returning fire.
Yes.
And this is, you know, this is one of those, like a lot of, whether it's the golden rule or, you know, a lot of philosophical concepts and statements that arise from different traditions and religion and philosophy that sound simple on the surface and yet are incredibly profound. And you as a designer, you know, I think that that's often the best type of design, as I had this explained to me when I was young, is design that appears simple but is actually quite complex in terms of the thought that was put into arranging it in a certain way and all that sort of thing. celebrate and uphold the freedom of art, science, and thought. That to me is, you know, when we think of inalienable rights, you know, a libertarian would say the right to property, and they would consider your own person your first piece of property, and you know, human rights, shelter, food, you know, all the sort of things that we associate with rights. To me, I think the most supreme of all of them is expression, creation, because you can't get from point A to point B with anything else of importance if you aren't free to explore, you know, from an intellectual standpoint, to discuss, to make mistakes, to fail, to disagree. So of all the objects, I think that's my favorite, because that's the one that I come back to with all of this. And that's the scariest thing about fundamentalism in religion or politics or anything else, is once things are so codified and unquestionable, it's like, well, before you, whatever good ideas there are in your fundamentalism, someone was expressing and creating and disagreeing to arrive there in the first place.
They were kind of whittling down to the answer.
So you can sort of remove that from the, to say that's no longer allowed in the process is death, you know.
How did you, so are you a Christian? Would you call yourself a Christian?
I do. I think it's, for lack of a better term to describe someone who follows the teachings and traditions of Christ. And to me, whether you believe that that's a historical figure who walked the earth, or a myth that was created after the fact, hundreds of years later, I, at this point in my life, fall back on that idea that that's sort of beside the point now.
Yeah.
You know, and I would say the same of literal resurrection, a literal hell, a literal heaven, a literal immaculate. You know, of course, a lot of what I'm saying is heresy to most of Christianity, most Christians. But for me, those things are the wrong questions. You know, that's, you know, you could, there's, I, one of the first things that turned me on as a teenager was the idea of the Jefferson Bible. And of course, Thomas Jefferson being a problematic figure through our modern lens in a lot of ways, but he had, you know, the Bible that he cut and paste and rearranged to remove all of the supernatural elements and the miracles and that sort of stuff, and just boil it down to the sayings and actions and teachings. And this isn't to say that I discount supernatural or mystical ideas. I'm quite intrigued and fascinated by them.
Yeah.
But I don't adhere to them as truths. I think that's more the fun stuff. You know, the truths, the truths to me are do unto others and love thy neighbor as thyself. And, you know, those kind of, those Christian forgiveness, those Christian concepts that are easy to adore and hard to an act.
Yeah, sure. I mean, how did you, or when did you get into it? Were you brought up as a Christian, or was it?
So on my father's side, my family is, you know, Irish Catholic culturally, you know, a couple generations removed from Ireland, but an Irish Catholic neighborhood in Indianapolis. And, you know,
You're not related to Brian Downey, are you? The drummer from Thin Lizzy.
I wish I was. Not that I know of. Maybe. Maybe through some distant, you know, distant, we may.
Yeah.
Maybe we're fourth cousins. But yeah, my dad had, you know, a lot of siblings and that sort of thing. And he refers to himself at this point as a recovering Catholic. And then on my mom's side, they came from the Presbyterian tradition. And my mom, at some point, similar to your mom, it sounds like, depending on how close in age we are, she was a born-again Christian, very much in that late 70s, early 80s mode of what born-again Christianity was all about. Mm-hmm. And so she was coming from that perspective. So I grew up, my formative years, I was raised by my mom as a single mom, and I went to Presbyterian church. And as a teenager, went through you know, is getting into punk and new wave and later thrash metal and hardcore and all of that stuff. And a lot of the ideas that I encountered there definitely went through that iconoclastic period of rejection and trying to recontextualize and understand things for myself. But unlike a lot of my peers, I never abandoned the idea of the supernatural or of a higher power at all. I always felt like that was throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And just because we were rejecting a lot of bad ideas didn't mean that every idea within those frameworks was bad. And I gravitated towards groups like the Bad Brains. And then when the Cro-Mags and Shelter and 108 introduced Krishna consciousness into the hardcore scene, I was always fascinated by all of that stuff. I never became an adherent to any one particular thing, but I was always, even when it came to radical politics, I was drawn to groups like the MOVE organization in Philadelphia, who were vegan sort of primitivists, that, you know, were ultimately, most famously, what they're known for is being firebombed and murdered by the police in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. But you know, when it came to politics, I was always interested in the spirituality that animated Malcolm X, or the spirituality that animated Martin Luther King, and what made those movements and those figures successful or impactful or influential. What separated them from a lot of secular movements that failed, I think, was that drive of a higher calling, whatever that is. So as an adult, I leaned into the Christian label as a bit of conversational shorthand, I think. And also as, you know, there's an idea in scripture of a childlike faith. And at a certain point I thought, you know, I am a skeptic by nature. I'm a critical thinker. I'm a cynic. At a certain point I thought, you know, what if I try to stop outsmarting this and just submit and relax into it? And by this, I mean some of these ideas that are central to the Christian faith and the Christian story.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, that's kind of where I've been since my 20s, I suppose. And the older I get, the less I have figured out and the more comfortable I've become. And you may have, you know, having listened to some episodes, you may have heard me say this before, the more comfortable I've become in the unknowing, in the mystery, and going from this idea of this quest for certainty that I was on as an adolescent and as a young adult to recognizing that there isn't certainty and that that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. Getting comfortable with that, I think.
Comfortable with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, someone just told me the other day that they love, and it's only happened a couple of times, they love when guests turn the tables and ask me, try to pin me down. So this will be, the listeners who love that are going to love that you did it. And that's why I just went for it without any shame.
Yeah, no, it's interesting though. Yeah. I mean, I think that's an interesting thing as well about you. You say your mum was the,
born again Presbyterian. Yeah.
Because it's sort of, it always felt like the kind of softer version. It's like the more new age, you know, lefty version, I suppose.
Yeah. The more progressive and yeah. And then when you look at like the Episcopalians and Presbyterians and some of the traditions in America, which is, you know, quite conservative leaning in its evangelicalism, those were some of the traditions that were first to be accepting of homosexuality and equal rights for women, and a lot of ideas that we think of as progressive or liberal, whether it's classical liberalism or however you want to define it. Sure. Yeah, those were, yeah, a bit hippie-ish in that sense. And my dad, you know, coming from Catholicism, certainly experienced a lot of the downsides of Catholicism and its rigidness and hypocrisies. And, you know, it's crazy to think that it wasn't that long ago how controversial it was for Sinead O'Connor to rip up a picture of the Pope on Saturday Night Live. And how now I feel like if that happened tonight, it would be like, well, of course she's doing that, because now we know, you know, The things she was motivated by when she tore up that photo were less known. You know,
absolutely.
But again, I know devout Catholics who their adherence to that faith drives them to literally feed the poor and look after their neighbors. And, you know, there's good coming out of it as much as, you know, the institutionalized bad.
Yes, possibly.
Possibly, right.
I mean, yeah, whether it kind of outweighs it. I mean, it's always been a funny one that, for me, like the... I mean, it's as obvious as just the fact that there's like golden thrones and sequined red slippers and all that business, let alone all of the nefarious activities and just, I don't know, just the bizarreness of it all. And I mean, is it still one of the biggest in the world? Like,
you know, I don't know how influential it is at that point. And it's funny, as we're taping this conversation, there was just news within the last 24 hours that the Pope has come out, no pun intended, in favor of same-sex civil unions. And it's like, you know, it's still not quite there, and it's sort of like, hey, thanks for almost catching up. But on the other hand, when you think about how slow that institution has been to evolve on a number of issues, and I'm sure there are, you know, hardcore adherents who think that it's the church bending to culture, and to them that's the perversion of the church, not the generations of institutionalized abuse, the shuffling around of different deviants. They'll see this as the poisoning. But to me, a lot of the negative things that we associate with the Christian tradition are things that are perversions and that are cultural influences. You know, this was explained to me in an episode I haven't released yet, but I recently learned that the word homosexual didn't appear in the English Bible until the 20th century. That's like an invention of the 40s, the fact that that word even is in the Bible. So when you have, you know, zealots telling you, the Bible says this, and it's like, that's really not thousands of years of that. It's like 100 years. So anyway, that's a whole tangent. But to get back to your point, you know, I saw a bumper sticker someone posted online this morning on the back of a truck, of course, that said, "If Jesus had a gun, he'd still be here." And it's like, okay, well, there's a number of. Other than Peter, lay down your sword, or the idea that, you know, one Nazarene with an AK-47 versus the Roman Legion, there's a whole bunch of stuff, you know, or would still be here. What does that mean? Are you saying, so are you not a believer? You don't think that Jesus is still here? Or if you mean literally, then you think that he would be a literal 2,000-year-old man? There's no universe in which that sticker makes any sense. And yet someone made it, someone bought it, someone put it on the back of their truck, and we know what they mean. We could guess. Mm-hmm. We could guess what that person might say.
It's that sort of stuff that I'm really interested in, I guess, is the kind of alongside the stuff that's, you know, I'm serious about, or I think it's the embracing the the world of kind of quackery, conspiracy theories, do you know what I mean? Just pushing the boundaries of like, what, how ridiculous can you take it with these kind of statements? Like, just exactly that, like the bumper sticker stuff. So it's I guess that was some inspiration behind the seven objects. Like, of course we need some tenets.
Yes.
And we could make them completely ridiculous and sort of hypocritical, but in fact, it's, you know, like I say, I do actually stand behind them.
And that actually leads us nicely into, because there's three more that we didn't cover. One is meet mistakes with forgiveness and determination, which we have kind of talked about as we spoke about the one right before. And then the second to last is really interesting to me.
Just before you move on from that, it's important to know that the meeting mistakes thing is, there's a big part of that, which is like meeting your own mistakes and to improve, and then also other people's. So again, it's just, you know, trying to be a little more tolerant, a little more equanimous. Equanimous is a word, isn't it?
It is now, if it wasn't before. We have canonized it here within the church of the cosmic skull. Yeah, I love that. Meet mistakes, your own mistakes. You know, I was thinking just a moment ago, my interest is way more in just disassembling and constantly renewing and refreshing and rebuilding my own faith, my own beliefs. And being open to new information and drawing new conclusions. And I feel that there's a need from sort of the hard right evangelical side of Christianity or fundamentalist Islam or what have you, to your Sam Harris's and your Dawkins, where there's a need to destroy the other person's entire foundation of beliefs.
Opposite sides of it,
yeah, to get in and take it apart and rebuild something new in its place on their behalf. And on both sides, I think it's done out of a genuine sense of a twisted kind of love or a belief in that they're doing the Lord's work, or whatever the atheist version of the Lord's work is, you know. And for me, it's like I want to constantly firebomb my own idols and structures of belief and constantly remake them. So, yeah, I love that idea that meeting the mistakes is about yours first and foremost. But I want to move on to do what you want with love in your heart, because, you know, of course, the famous Aleister Crowley, Anton LaVey, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. This is different from that, because that doesn't have with love in your heart attached to it.
No, but the Crowley one does have the addendum, doesn't it? Which is
the love is the law, or
love is the law, love under will. But yeah, I mean, it's not just completely derivative of that. It's.
I didn't mean to imply it was derivative. It's distinguished.
It's based on that, but it's kind of, again, I think that is more to do with sort of got that chaos magic thing going on, hasn't it, where they're like, it's willing things to happen, basically making things happen, and then that can be with, you know, normal tools and, you know, the power of suggestion, etc. This is more kind of like aim to do the things that you want to do. You know, it's in a similar sense to the everybody's going to die. So let's try and do what we want to do.
And the idea that love in your heart, that there's a purity of intention there as opposed to malice in your heart or selfishness or
you know,
all the things that we would
just go out and sort of do whatever our whims
conquer and kill and all that stuff. Maintain focus on the unity of all living beings. And what I love about that one is its corollaries and overlap with all of the world's, the traditions that have endured, right? Because we have a lot of new religions and sects and cults and strains and strands from the last like 100 years or so. But the ones that have really proven to stand the test of time, they all have something in there that's a lot like that seventh. And of course, it's, you know, can be debated all day long to what extent each faith tradition actually practices that.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's certainly the thing to aspire to, I think. Talk to me about that, about developing that one and making sure it was in there.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's like, obviously, you know, especially with things that are going on nowadays, it's not really saying that like we are all kind of the same and, you know, we should all agree. It's more like just there is some common thread, so let's not be dicks to each other. It's not actually that hard.
A unity and diversity. I think that that's always key with unity. Because oftentimes you think of unity and peace as being a vanilla sort of Ned Flanders, homogenous, you know.
Everybody wearing white clothes with a rainbow in the sky. And
that's not everybody, though. That's one particular, you know. My fellowship all wearing black clothes with the black rainbow in the sky. We can unite with yours.
Exactly.
It's the unity and diversity. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it goes without saying. I mean, I think like I would obviously, well, what I thought was kind of obvious is that from these seven objects, we would, without getting like political, it seems clear from these that we would sort of lean maybe traditionally towards the left and the center, possibly. But it kind of seems that the center is shifting slightly now.
Mm.
It's almost like the left, some left ideas that are kind of actually quite reasonable and what used to be quite centrist are now being branded as being extreme kind of socialist ideas. Mm. So actually being kind of centrist is, the pendulum swayed. So being centrist is actually being fairly right wing nowadays, which generally doesn't, align itself with the unity of all living beings.
And it's interesting how from the faith and spirituality position, the left has been, I mean, you know, going back obviously to Trotskyites and Marx and, you know, however far back you want to go, but the left has been associated with a rejection of religion. And it's interesting to me and something I'd like to explore in future conversations on this podcast, to see the left right now really embracing astrology and the secret, you know, the idea that you can, a sort of wish fulfillment, you know, rejecting the idea of the sky wizard that's listening to all of your thoughts and watching all of your deeds, but then in the same turn going, yeah, I read this book that tells you if you really think about something, you can manifest it and it can be yours. And I'm not casting aspersions on anyone adhering to any side of anything I just mentioned, but I find it interesting that traditionally the left liberal side is thought of as not indulging anything remotely supernatural. And yet now, astrology is popular again, and it's interesting because then there's also this whole sort of forgotten left, progressive liberation theology and Latin American priests, and as you said, some of the Protestantism in America in the 60s and 70s that was very much socially progressive, politically progressive.
Yeah,
so there's a whole spectrum. I don't mean to,
I think the left and the right is just, it's a construction which has been kind of created by politics, which isn't actually real. I mean, it's, I think everybody, both sides, even the extreme sides, do basically just care about other people and the good of humanity. It's just, I mean, to me, it almost seems as if like, to some extent, the right is kind of fueled by capitalism, and like the more money you have, the more likely you are to be leaning to the right because you want to protect your family, your bloodline, your inheritance.
Or if you aspire to have a lot of money, even if you don't have it, And that's how you end up with a lot of these folks where they say they vote against their own interests, because they're that whole idea of temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Is that that's Mark Twain, or I think that's a Mark Twain quote. Yeah, but yes, to your point. Yes, it seems.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just a shame that I think that it's, you know, I mean, without wanting to go too conspiracy theorist about it, it's definitely a construction that there's just these two options, blue and red, and it's all kind of
team sports.
Yeah.
Every event that happens around the world, it's immediately interpreted through the lens of, well, how does my team see this?
Yeah, I mean, it's literally become, you know, American wrestling with just the way it's even presented now. I mean, over here with like Boris and Trump, obviously, it's just, you know, the whole, just regardless of the characters, it's all the fact that they are portrayed almost like cartoon characters, and like, you know, it's kind of like people doing the, what's that thing when they're just they're sort of shouting at the camera about how they're going to suplex the next guy.
Yeah. And in fact, I just saw a commercial last night for the upcoming third and, or whatever you want to call it, what was supposed to have been the third and final presidential debate of this cycle. And this was on a mainstream network, not even a cable news network. And the ad, bringing us full circle to like you were talking about the gospel singer, the ad had this dramatic music. It was like a film trailer, you know, and almost like a subliminal, but it was very like, at the first debate, this happened, and this guy was this way, and this guy was this way, and tomorrow night, right here on this channel, will be, the, you know, and it's like, man, we're, but it's not a movie. It's, you know, it's not professional wrestling. Like, this is supposed to be of import. Yeah.
Well, I suppose, I mean, this is something which, you know, we've tried to sort of toy with a little, just to sort of bring it back to like the reason we're going on about this, I guess, is like I was talking to a student who was writing a paper on sort of the use of drama or dramatics in religion, and they sort of sent us a couple of questions about just, you know, how we. Because obviously we do a live show, which incorporates some of these factors, and such a big part of it is that concept of like you instill fear with, you know, just sound and light. You know, like this, we do a big kind of like projection, kind of light show and stuff. So you instill this sense of fear. And then you are the kind of relief from that fear, which is something which, you know, it's a tried and tested thing that like evangelist preachers do.
Yeah.
And I, you know, again, I don't, it's not as if I'm boiling this down to some sort of trick that, you know, everybody who's religious has fallen for some trick. The point is that it doesn't matter if you know that it's a trick, or it doesn't matter if.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? The point is that the experience of it is just very enjoyable. It's like I'd happily go to like a gospel church and see this thing and get right in and, you know, get really involved. And I think I could go along with it. And it'd be maybe a suspension of belief at that point. But I think that's sort of what a lot of people get from going to sort of heavy metal shows, punk shows, you know, just the danger of like the mosh pit, the big crowd, everybody's jostling. So it's a very threatening environment, isn't it? You know, but it's like, then we're all together.
And as you said, the sort of manipulation, the emotional manipulation that's happening and that you're willfully surrendering to it. And I immediately thought of, going to see Metallica and the ecstasy of gold. Yeah, the Ecstasy of Gold, right? From The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly opens every show, and that kicks in. And yeah. You know, like, as soon as this song is over, the band's coming out, and mm-hmm. there's going to be explosions and fire and my favorite songs. You're going along with it. You know, you're signing up to be manipulated that way. Yeah.
This is it, yeah. And it's the same with, like you were saying, with Alice Cooper and Kiss. Any of these bands that, you know, they go for the sort of, you know, on the face of it, what is it's basically a laughable kind of costume. The whole thing is ridiculous, but...
Raven. Picturing Raven right now. Yeah.
It all kind of, it just makes for like a real immersive experience in the live setting, which sadly we can't experience for some indefinite period of time.
Yeah, when you mentioned how going into the crowds is how there's a danger, it's like, yeah, that's it's become much more literal now. Much higher risk. Well, this has been fantastic and fascinating, as I knew that it would be. I'd like to ask you one last thing, which is, how does the solo work differ from the stuff with the band? And then, I mean, aside from just being able to listen to it and tell the difference, I mean, for you as the creative engine behind both, you know, how do you decide do you sit down with the intention of I'm writing something for the solo stuff or I'm writing something for the band, or does it more sort of tell you what it's going to be? And, you know, how does that distinction be?
Well, it's the main difference would be I like to kind of set limits on different creative projects. So the limits for Church are, it is that selection of instruments, which is drums, bass, guitar, some kind of one stringed instrument, which is now a viola, but was a cello, and keys, which, you know, again, there's a bit of looseness there because he's playing Hammond and piano and a bit of Wurlitzer and Rhodes. But the point is that we don't go into the realms of, like, let's have sort of 9 string tracks or let's have, like, multiple guitar harmonies over the top of each other. Mm-hmm. Same with the voices. They'll just be the 5 of us singing. So it creates a coherence. It means that you can basically do like lots of different, you know, heavy songs, light songs, poppy stuff, metal stuff, loads of different things, because there's one, you know, there's always that kind of consistent sound. It keeps it coherent. So conversely, with the solo thing, the idea was to experiment with, it's just going to be bass, drums and guitar, but I'm gonna just layer up the guitars as much as I want, which I wouldn't ever do in Church, and I'll layer up my own vocals in harmonies. But to be honest, I mean, a lot of it was just, it was old songs that I'd, or old sort of bits of songs that I'd sort of been playing around with on drums. It's a lot more, it's just a lot heavier. It's more sort of 90s kind of Smashing Pumpkins influenced, sort of lyrically or like concept wise. It's more about, well, this particular album is very kind of psychology based as opposed to like religious. So
thematically even, yeah, there's opportunity to do.
Yeah. So, the theme of it is all the dark triad, which I don't know if you're familiar with, is three traits, narcissism, psychopathy, Machiavellianism. So the general gist is that these three traits are being actively encouraged in today's society and within the capitalist world. So, and that maybe by noticing them in ourselves, we can change that path. Mm. So there's a bunch of songs on there which are sort of related to that. So I wouldn't go so far as saying it's a concept album, but it's kind of, it does have that running theme.
It's got guideposts almost, right, that appear and reappear. And those are all things, all of those things in the triad are all things that relate to just about everything we've talked about.
I mean, it's like, I don't want to be kind of preachy. Like, again, the whole thing is sort of, you know, I find it sort of, I can't really do anything without a slight tongue-in-cheek kind of sheen of cynicism over the entire thing. Do you know what I mean? Pushing it into the realms of the ridiculous. But they're just sort of really interesting concepts that I've been sort of thinking about recently. And you just, it's like anything, you just start seeing them everywhere, don't you? You know, it's all of these personalities in the news.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of, you know, which of these dark triad traits are they displaying? Often all of them.
Simultaneously in concert with one another. Yeah. Pun intended, I suppose. Well, Brother Bill, thank you very much for accepting the invitation and coming on.
Thank you, Ryan. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Absolutely.